welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill, and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, November 21st, 2020. I do hope you're all well and staying safe.
Bound to wander, born to roam. When we stole ourselves out of that town.
The music I'm playing this week is a track from an American bluegrass band called the Rackhouse Pilfer. It's entitled Fallen Leaves, in keeping with the season. That makes this title very appropriate, I think. They've generously allowed us to use it on Talking Newspapers. As usual, I'll play it in full at the end of the programme.
We were singing a song.
This week, following the news stories and radio listings, we have Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes and a couple of articles from Hearts Life magazine. The first of these is about the Fire King, Arthur Brock, whose fireworks firm, originally established in Islington in 1668, moved to Hemel Hempstead in 1933. The second is the story of Violet Cressy Marks, the most travelled woman of her age. We'll start with the news, and our readers this week are Elizabeth, Sarah, Dominic and Ian.
Just get us to the church on time.
Hello, I'm Sarah.
Couple rearrange wedding in 3 days to avoid lockdown acts. A weekend wedding was rearranged in a day to avoid being ruined by the second lockdown. Local couple, Naomi Sakai and Dominic Gilbert, had planned their big day for Saturday, the November the 7th, but had to reschedule in a matter of hours and bring it 3 days forward. They ended up getting married on the afternoon of November the 4th in St Helen's Church in Wheathampstead, with 13 people attending in masks. Naomi said, "I didn't really notice the masks. It's something I've got used to seeing now. The only people who did not wear a mask were my husband and I and the rector." Following Boris Johnson's announcement of a new lockdown in England, the couple talked on Sunday evening about bringing the wedding day forward, and by Monday, they'd managed to do it. Naomi said, "It was the same wedding, but 3 days earlier. All the supplies were amazing. The church and the village community have really come together to make this happen for us. Everyone who was supposed to come could make it, apart from one person who had to work, and she's a hospital doctor." Naomi, 31, is a doctor at the Whittington Hospital, and Dominic, 33, is an actuary. "We had a small reception afterwards in the church with coffee and cake provided by Charlie's Cafe in Wheathampstead." The newlyweds, who now live in Wellingarden City, plan to have a get-together in Japan, as many of her family and friends live there. Having booked to go to the Lake District for their honeymoon, they're now enjoying time off work together at home. Naomi added, "We've been doing gardening, but we will go away when it's all over." Although Naomi and Dominic felt disappointed by the thought of having to postpone their wedding, Naomi said, "Rearranging it has really brought us hope and made us feel very loved by the fact that people really made a big effort to be there on our special day. We got lots of lovely gifts and we're particularly enjoying our new pizza oven. Dominic and I are very grateful for the generosity of the vicar who helped us in so many ways, even sorting out the flowers for the church."
Hello, my name is Dominic, and the first story has the headline, "Redbourne Cricket Club honoured for summer of success and achievements." A village cricket club has been honoured for its outstanding national achievements. A socially distanced presentation was held at Redbourne Cricket Club on Saturday, October the 31st, to recognise the team's performance over the summer. Councillor Annie Brewster said, "We were all so proud Redbourne Cricket Club made it through 7 gruelling rounds all the way to the final of the National Village Cricket Cup at Lord's. However, we are equally heartbroken none of us were allowed to come and support you in the match due to COVID-19 restrictions. Having attracted over 600 spectators to your semi-final, I'm sure the entire village and much of Hertfordshire would have flocked to Lord's in any other year." Despite team captain Ed Hales scoring the first century in the competition since 2016, Redbourne lost to Colwall Cricket Club on the final ball. With senior dignitaries in Hertfordshire feeling the team's achievement needed to be formally recognised, the Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, Robert Voss, CBE, presented a commemorative signed cricket bat to the club chairman, Anthony Morder. Mr. Voss said, "You have made your village and the entire county of Hertfordshire extremely proud. Congratulations to everyone in the team and indeed all the coaches and families behind your success. I am so impressed you have over 250 boys and girls at Redbourne Cricket Club, and it is testament to the club that the majority of the Lord's team came through your junior ranks." Anthony added, "Although we so narrowly lost, Ed's century was outstanding, starting in remarkable fashion with a six off his very first ball. It was a privilege to be one of just 15 people from each team allowed into the 30,000 capacity ground at Lord's to witness the final, and an honour to have distinguished guests come to Redbourne to recognise our achievement." The High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, Henry Holland Hibbert, presented a bat to century-scoring captain. On receiving the commemorative bat, Ed said, "I am overwhelmed by this honour, but our success is thanks to the entire team and the incredible club we have behind us. The experience of Lord's was insane, thinking of the cricket greats of history who have played at this hallowed ground." And accompanying the story is a picture which shows the High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, Henry Holland Hibbert, presenting a commemorative bat to team captain Ed Hales.
Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Briggs. And my first article from the Hart Advertiser is "Council to Consider a 20 miles per hour limit on roads." A petition to introduce a 20 miles per hour speed limit in towns and villages in Hertfordshire will be considered after the campaign reached its target of 250 signatures in just one day. Hart County Council's Highways Panel will discuss a default 20 miles per hour limit at their meeting on November the 19th, which of course is today. Colin Hodges, 20 is plenty for St Albans District campaigner, said, "We are delighted at how quickly local people have come forward and signed our petition. It's great to see the support for lower speed limits for Hertfordshire towns and villages. Residents wanted the speed of a road to be based on safety and the environment rather than the current speed of vehicles." Colin added, "Lower speeds make roads safer, quieter, can reduce air pollution, and with more people cycling and walking, boost trade at local shops. We are delighted that so many people have already come forward to sign our petition asking Hertfordshire County Council for 20 miles per hour to replace 30 miles per hour. Already, 40 local authorities across the UK have opted to lower speed limits, and we think it's time for Hertfordshire residents to benefit from lower speed limits too." Having collected over 250 signatures on their petition, a member of 20's Plenty for Hertfordshire will speak at the meeting. On October the 20th, Councillor John Hale put forward a motion to Hearts County Council supporting the cause. He stated, "Adopt a 20 mile per hour speed limit as the default speed limit in areas where vulnerable road users and vehicles mix in a frequent and planned manner, noting that efforts to reduce speed in general will have a beneficial impact on air quality and climate change, as well as being vital to reduce road traffic deaths and injuries. The Hertfordshire Speed Management Strategy will provide the framework for evaluating all proposed changes to speed limits. It's important we act now," added Colin. "Unless we can persuade the Hearts County Council Highways Cabinet Panel to enable town or village-wide 20 miles per hour areas in the speed management strategy now, it will be almost impossible for 20 miles per hour to become the default speed limit in St Albans or anywhere else in the county. To sign the petition, visit Hertfordshire County Council's website."
Hello, I'm Ian. Out of this world pupil wins NASA competition. a St Albans schoolboy has gone to infinity and beyond by winning a NASA competition. Designing a lunar loo fit for space, budding scientist and inventor Joel Aron, 10, beat 900 other entries with his Artemis Easy Loo. The St Albans and Stephen Catholic Primary School pupil wowed NASA's Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate, rocketing to the top to claim the first place prize. Joel's design utilizes a saddle-shaped seat with an adjustable guard, suction, one-way flaps, smart sensors, disinfectant, and anti-stick spray. With the Artemis program, NASA will land the first woman on the moon in 2024. The Lunar Loo challenge was to design a compact, easy-to-use toilet integrated into lunar landers. Head teacher Aideen Porter said, "What a fantastic achievement, Joel. He wishes to be an inventor when he grows up, and we have every faith that his dream will come true." Joel was presented with a signed photo from one of the astronauts who will be on the mission to commemorate his achievement. And the article was accompanied by a picture of Joel with a signed picture of a female astronaut.
Diwali celebrations set to light up our city. St Albans was illuminated with Diva lamps and Rangoli patterns to celebrate Diwali on Saturday. The Diwali Festival of Light Trail could be seen in the run-up to the festival and was organised by Preet Cox of St Albans Rainbow Trail. Residents of the district were invited to display traditional Diwali decorations in their windows or chalk patterns onto the ground. With the celebration of religious holidays being different this year due to the pandemic, Preet encouraged people from all faiths and religions to take part to spread cheer and unite the district. Preet said, "The festival of Diwali is celebrated across the world by Hindus, Sikhs and Jains. It's a festival of lights and represents light over darkness and good over evil. This year, Diwali shall be celebrated very differently compared to the usual celebrations due to the restrictions within the pandemic. The Diwali Festival of Lights initiative by the St Albans Rainbow Trail aims to spread some cheer in celebration of the festival and is the first collective Diwali celebration initiative organised across the district of St Albans, which is quite special. Allowing the community to mark the celebration in a safe and virtual way," Preet added, "the response has been fantastic, and many schools have also taken part through their activities of creating divas and Rangoli designs, which is wonderful to see. Residents of St Albans came out in force to get involved in the first Diwali community initiative organised in the district. For more information about the Diwali Trail and for upcoming events, visit St Albans Rainbow Trail on Facebook." And the article is accompanied by some lovely pictures of children holding their Diwali lights that they've made at school. Clock Tower Competition. The young winners of a competition to design innovative ways to get down from the top of St Albans Clock Tower have been unveiled. St Albans and Hertfordshire Archaeological and Architectural Society, Arc and Arc, asked entrants to come up with creative ways of how visitors to the St Albans landmark would descend back down from the top while still complying to social distancing rules. The entries were judged on their creativity, practicality and fun by a panel from the Arc and Arc, St Albans Museum and Gallery and the Hearts Advertiser. Hazel Bigmore, aged 7, Alex Matchett, aged 11, and 13-year-old Dylan Jackson Gibbs were awarded the top prize for their imaginative ideas. Caroline Hawkins, from the organisation who arranged the competition, said, "The designs were so imaginative with wonderful creative ideas and lovely drawings. I look forward to welcoming the winners and their families to the Clock Tower when it's allowed to open again in happier times." And the article is accompanied by a lovely picture of a little boy with his very funny diagram of how people would descend from the clock tower by ropes.
Local plan withdrawal could mean a fresh start for our city. Councillors are to consider formally withdrawing St Albans' draft local plan this week. The plan is a document designed to act as the blueprint for future growth and development across the district until 2036 and includes a number of sites that have been earmarked to enable the construction of new homes to meet demand for 913 new homes a year. Earlier this year, planning inspectors pointed to serious concerns and halted their public examination of the document, which needs to have government approval. On Thursday, a meeting of St Albans City and District Council's Cabinet will be asked to formally withdraw the local plan. Speaking in advance of that meeting, portfolio holder for planning, Councillor Jamie Day, said that withdrawal of the plan would give the council a fresh start. He added, "We have no choice but to withdraw the draft local plan given the disappointing response of the government-appointed planning inspectors. At least we can now embark on a fresh start, which gives us an opportunity to better address issues which have become ever more pressing since the draft was first drawn up. These include the need to recognise the impact of climate change and the need to ensure any new developments will meet strong sustainability standards." Councillor Day highlighted that the draft also focused to an extent on large developments of 500 houses or more, which would have a huge impact on the district. He added, "We will look to see if we can concentrate more on smaller sites, which will take up less of the green belt." If the Cabinet agrees to formally withdraw the draft local plan, a detailed draft timetable of future work would be considered by the Council's Planning Policy Committee in December. At an earlier meeting, the Council's Planning Policy Committee had highlighted Sevenoaks District Council, which is reported to be seeking judicial review. There had been calls for St Albans to delay a decision on their own draft local plan until the judgment from the Sevenoaks Judicial Review had been published.
This article is entitled Charity Run, and there's a lovely picture of a St Albans family, father, mother, little girl, little boy, all smiling broadly. A St Albans cancer survivor ran 13 kilometres to mark the second anniversary of her chemotherapy ending. Kate Sizer of Ladysmith Road ran from her house to Chilickbury Park and back on Saturday, and has so far raised £2,321 for the charity that supported her when she was unwell. The Willow Foundation provides special days for young adults who are enduring different conditions and treatments. Kate said, "I am forever grateful that I got another roll of the dice, and I appreciate that some of you have witnessed others who weren't as lucky as we've been. Those people will be in my heart as I run, and I promise that they will remain in my thoughts always. I did this for those fighting, and those who have fought and are now resting peacefully. They paid for us to have a weekend at Centre Parks, which helped us to relaunch our family after 6 months of endless hospital appointments."
Homeless charity pleads for people for virtual sleepout. Will you brave the cold to support the homeless? Local charity Hearts Young Homeless is asking for volunteers to join them for their biggest fundraiser of the year, a virtual annual sleepout on Friday, November the 20th. The organisation, which focuses on preventing homelessness by delivering education in schools and facilitating family mediation, provides support to 16 to 24-year-olds in their first homes and those who have mental health issues and housing needs. This year, due to coronavirus and social distancing restrictions, their annual sleepout event will be very different and has been reimagined as Sleepout at Home. All you have to do to take part is pitch up a tent in the garden, make beds on the floor, or take to your sofas for the night and have your friends and family sponsor your efforts. A spokesman for the charity said, "Demand for our services has risen hugely this year due to the pandemic. That's why we must come together as a community and help support those who are in need. With your support and sponsorship, we can continue our vital work." Even £30 worth of sponsorship would enable them to buy essential food supplies for a young person for a month. Participants in the Sleep Out at Home event will receive a Sleep Out survival kit, including a T-shirt, in advance of the night. They will also have access to a live Zoom stream with music and entertainment to keep up their spirits during the long night ahead. Those volunteers who raise over £250 in sponsorship will also be presented with a free sleep-out hoodie. The spokesperson added, "This year's event is our most important one yet and is pivotal for us to continue providing our services to young people. It's the perfect way to take part in something exciting with your friends and family whilst also helping your local community. So wrap up warm with your family and help raise money and awareness of homelessness with us. We've never needed you more." To find out more about the event and how to take part, visit www.hyh.org.uk/sponsored-sleepout.
It's Okay to Say launches Christmas song campaign. As part of It's Okay to Say's ongoing mission to remind people that they have a voice, founder Stacey Turner is recording a special song for Christmas. She will be teaming up with the Desert Penguins to remotely record an as yet undecided track as part of the hashtag Find Your Voice campaign, which aims to encourage people to keep connected through the current lockdown and beyond. Stacey explained, "I was inspired to create this campaign following many conversations with people saying that they're struggling to stay connected through a time when we're being told to social distance and to isolate. I want to make people laugh and give them something to look forward to, and all the money raised will pay for mental health support for all ages. It's Okay to Say is expanding, and we intend to be there for you. Our new support system will dovetail nicely with the hashtag Find Your Voice campaign, leading the way into the new year. I'm nervous, so bear with me and encourage me along. I'm grateful for the Desert Penguins for joining me to make this campaign happen." She laughed, "I certainly have a vocal challenge ahead of me, but I'm up for it. I'm working with a vocal coach to highlight that you can find your voice too. It's okay to say and to reach out for help. My vocal coach and the Desert Penguins are helping me to find my voice for this challenge, to raise awareness and hopefully some much needed funds. I may not be vocally blessed, but I'm prepared to work hard and hopefully make you laugh along the way." Tom Mayer, leading guitar for the Desert Penguins, said, "After Stacey reached out with the opportunity of working with a mental health charity, I knew straight away it was something the band and I would support. Music is something that's always been there to take us through the good times and help carry us through the bad. It doesn't matter what type of music it is. If you have a connection with it and it means something to you, then that's all that matters." The work that It's Okay to Say does to support those in need is fantastic. Not only encouraging people to talk more about their mental well-being, but also reminding people it's equally as important to listen. During the second lockdown and approaching what will be a difficult Christmas time, this awareness is more important than ever. We're honoured that we've been approached as a band to be involved, support and to help raise awareness for such an important cause. Due to lockdown, Stacey and the band will remotely record the song and post live chats on social media so followers can share the journey of hashtag Find Your Voice campaign and to be inspired. Chats will include song choice, progression, messages of support, contributors, helplines and further support. Tom added, "We look forward to taking everyone along with us on this journey by posting some behind-the-scenes videos, sneak peeks and snippets of what we're up to. And we can't wait to start working with Stacey and see her learn the song and working on the vocals. We're eager to get started on this project and support It's Okay to Say in the run-up to Christmas, which can be a difficult time for some, especially in 2020. Over the next month or so, we look to finalise a song choice to suit Stacey's voice, work hard to learn it and make our own, likely all remotely, and record it from home. Alongside this, we will come up with an inventive way to create an awesome supporting video to go along with it. If you need to chat, text SHOUT, S-H-O-U-T, to 85258 for free 24/7 support in the UK.
And now an obituary for Jamie Wilding. An inspirational Harpenden fundraiser has died aged just 30 following an 8-year battle with heart failure. Jeremy Wilding spent his life fundraising for various charities and was passionate about helping others, even when he was poorly himself. He underwent 2 liver transplants in the early 2000s and suffered with septic shock and multi-organ failure in 2012. The septic shock damaged his aortic valve, meaning he'd require a heart transplant. He had 4 open heart surgeries in a 24-hour period and spent time on an artificial heart machine. Jamie sadly died on the 11th of October. Jamie's friend Amy described how he lived his life to the fullest when he was well enough to do so. She said, "I had the pleasure of climbing the O2 with Jamie, and watching him reach the top was the most amazing experience I have ever had. Knowing what he'd been through and him persevering, it was a life-changing experience. He loved doing things for charity and giving back, and I had the pleasure of calling him a dear friend. I have never felt as proud as I did that day." Nick Hartshorne-Evans, founder of the Pumping Marvellous Foundation, the UK's patient-led heart failure charity, said, "Where'd you start with Jamie? While Jamie volunteered for the Pumping Marvellous Foundation, you could always guarantee comments of amazement and wow. Jamie genuinely touched the hearts of everyone he met. Jamie managed to get across his challenges, life experiences and insights, package it up and get people to believe him. We, the charity team, are already missing him. Heart failure is relentless. You are ordinarily breathless, fatigued and sometimes full of fluid, all because your heart isn't pumping properly. Jamie didn't fail. He totally succeeded. One of the toughest people I have ever known. Rest well." Jamie detailed his illness and recovery periods on his blog, It's Only Time Anyway, inviting readers to come on his journey with him. Jamie's biggest loves in his life are his friends, family, and going on holidays. He was also a lifelong Luton Town Football Club supporter. A Just Giving page has been set up to raise money for Jamie's family to help pay for his funeral. To donate, visit justgiving.com/crowdfunding/Tilly-Shaw. And accompanying the obituary is a picture of Jamie on top of the O2 on a gloriously sunny day, with both of them smiling.
School's Outdoor Pursuits. And there's a lovely photograph of Roundwood Primary children outside, well rugged up in thick coats, but obviously having a lovely time. Children at Roundwood Primary joined thousands of other pupils across the country to prove why time outdoors should be part of every school day. Outdoor Classroom Day started in London in 2012 and aims to make outdoor play and learning part of every child's day. Organisers say it is critical to children's health, well-being and happiness. Roundwood's head teacher, Mrs. Hooft, said, "There is a wealth of evidence that suggests that outdoor learning and time to play outdoors throughout the school day are beneficial to children, and I couldn't agree more. When our children are outdoors, they are more engaged, their mood is lifted, and they are more active. Following our involvement in Outdoor Classroom Day, we will be taking a serious look at how we integrate more time outdoors into every school day."
St. Albans BID has boosted local economy, new report states. A report has found that St. Albans Business Improvement District, BID, has taken on an important role in developing the local economy since its formation. St. Albans BID came into force in April 2017 to provide additional services to people who live and work in the city centre. During the pandemic, St. Albans BID has been crucial in enhancing the essential work undertaken by St. Albans District Council, the report says. This has included employing BID rangers who have been patrolling the city centre, advising shoppers and businesses on COVID safety regulations. BID promoted the Inside Out St. Albans campaign allowing businesses to operate on the street, and was involved in the decision to temporarily pedestrianise some city centre streets. The report about the work of St Albans BID was given to a meeting of the Council's Community, Environment and Sport Scrutiny Committee. The committee also heard about the work of St Albans Visitor Partnership, with which BID is involved. The partnership is currently working on a strategy funded by the BID to make the district a first-class destination for visitors. Councillor Annie Brewster, the committee's chair, said after the meeting, "We felt it important to invite representatives from St Albans BID to our scrutiny meeting as they have such a close association with the council. The overwhelming view of the committee was that it is doing an excellent job in promoting our local businesses and providing a range of additional services, many of which residents assume the council provides exclusively. It has been particularly active during the COVID pandemic, balancing the need to keep people safe with the need to ensure our local economy can come through this crisis in reasonable shape. Looking further into the future, the work the BID is doing as a key member of St Albans Visitor Partnership has the potential to turn the city, with its unique heritage and host of great attractions, into a major visitor destination. The committee felt that this ambition has to be district-wide, and we are already seeing many BID initiatives that flow both ways. Surrounding parishes are encouraged to share information about their visitor attractions and events so we can support one another." And accompanying the article is a picture from Wheat Hampstead, from the Wheat Hampstead Heritage Trail and the Crinkle Crankle Garden.
Now is an opportunity for change, not despair. Halfway through the second lockdown, it's crucial to keep the momentum going for businesses struggling to trade. With Christmas just over a month away, the Hearts Ad is keeping the pressure with our Shop Local campaign. If you're looking for present ideas, steer away from the likes of Amazon and eBay and shop online with our local retailers. Jess Patel, co-owner of Tomoka Spirits Boutique in Christopher Place Shopping Centre, said that they've adapted well to the COVID situation, but missing out on a government bounce-back loan prevented them from substantially expanding their online business. As a result, it's essential that they have a successful Christmas, as this is their main income period of the year. But he's also aware of the need to adapt to the ongoing challenges faced by all retailers. He said, "I feel people are willing and want to spend money, but the government needs to make this possible and support all retailers. My personal opinion is that business owners need to stop moaning about what's going wrong and waiting for the government to help, because they will not, and instead be proactive and make changes, diversify and be fluid in your business model. Otherwise they will close, and that's a fact. Look at other revenue streams that you can generate through your location and put into practice something you've always wanted to do but never had the energy to do so. Now can be an opportunity for change, not just despair." He explained how they've adjusted their own business model. "We have had an online shop dedicated to craft gins for a few years, but never had the money to expand the awareness or indeed to compete against our larger competitors. The first lockdown gave us a chance to create something unique and expand our shop experience into the virtual realm, and also helped us to increase our general online sales. We were able to move quickly to offer virtual tastings online, which allowed us to reach the whole country. So we were no longer just trying to survive in St Albans, our reach was national. We also worked very closely with our suppliers, which gave us cash flow and increased trust as we move forward into the future." He joined other retailers in backing the Hearts Ad campaign. "If people want a high street, if people want a nice place to shop and to be offered lots of great choices across both daytime and the nighttime economy, then they have to support it. And as I mentioned earlier, I think the public's ready to do so." Just out of the city centre, in Hatfield Road in Fleetville, gift shop Gather and Give has had a bumpy ride since opening its doors last December. Owner Catalina Martin explained how she was forced to close just a few months later. I'm a mum of three, and unfortunately COVID massively affected my childcare situation, so I'm still closed for the time being. Opening a store 3 days a week just isn't feasible, both financially and in terms of customer experience. The juggling's proving more difficult than ever. I've a beautiful website, which is easy to navigate, great fun to shop, and I've offered free local delivery since March, dropping off customers' orders straight to their doors. I'm now open for collections of online orders and will be offering shopping days and private shopping appointments from November. The other issue I face is that I'm a very small store, and trying to keep everyone safe is hugely important to me. This may mean that I can only have one or two customers in at a time, which could put some customers off. She said it's vital that they have a successful festival season. Describing this Christmas as make or break sounds dramatic, but it really is. Paying rent on an empty shop throughout lockdown has really taken a toll on my business, and the fact that I've been closed longer than I've been open is heartbreaking. Opening a shop any time is a big challenge, but opening one just before 2020 has been harder than any of us could have imagined. I'm a sustainable gift store, so as you can imagine, Christmas plays a very big role in my sales. I can also post gifts straight to loved ones, handwriting messages in greeting cards. My new collection of gift boxes even arrive with a personalised gift tag and tied in a bow, perfect for presents. She urged readers to support our independent shops because of the vibrancy and life that they bring to the city. There's nothing better than popping into a small indie store and finding a treasure trove of interesting and exciting gifts for yourself and a loved one. We're local people ourselves and want the best for our city. I grew up in St Albans, and now I'm raising my own family here too. I'm so proud to be able to bring something to my community and support our local economy.
Why online can also help our local retailers. As part of the hashtag ShopLocal campaign, we have been highlighting what website services our independent shops are providing. But we are also fortunate enough to have plenty of purely digital businesses operating from the district. With a second lockdown now underway, there's no excuse not to still shop local. Online. Rosie Sorrell, brackets rosiesorrell.com, is a gift shop selling homewares, prints, kitchen accessories, jewellery and clothing. Founder Sarah Luck explained, "We provide rainbow and retro-inspired home and kitchen wares, from mugs to tea towels hand-printed in Marshallswick. Tablecloths, towels, interior decor, all inspired by the colourful retro styles of the 70s, with some Scandinavian and Polish folk art thrown in. You will find something unique and colourful in our shop. We're also one of the few UK retailers of Australia-based jewellery brand Eswilder, with their pin-up style brooches, necklaces and scarves." She is urging residents to choose locally based online retailers instead of multinationals. She said, "When a consumer spends their money with a local small business, not only are they supporting that business, but other local businesses too. I know I use as many local businesses as possible as my suppliers, and this contributes to sustaining the local economy." Also, local independent retailers bring an element of individualism with unique product ranges and designs that you won't find in larger outlets. "Often the service provided by small businesses are of a high standard, as we take pride in the service we provide and understand that people appreciate a high level of customer service. And we too greatly appreciate our customers. For example, I spend a lot of time sourcing and deciding on the freebies we add to all our orders, just to give that personal touch and added value. A reward, if you like, for supporting small." Freelance designer Hannah Sessions runs Hannah Sessions Design, brackets www.hannahsessionsdesign.com, creating hand-drawn artwork including a range of products featuring St Albans maps and pubs, which she sells online and as part of St Albans Charter Market. "The main challenges that I am facing at this moment is the massive level of uncertainty about what will happen from day to day and whether we will be trading till Christmas normally. For me and many others, Christmas is a massive focal point in the year, and the income from this should help us to get through the first quarter of next year. Because of this, I do feel that this is a definite make-or-break situation for many, sadly. I do feel very strongly about the independent shops in town. It is these shops that contribute to our unique city centre. They make our high street different from other surrounding towns. If we lose these, we will lose businesses that have been around many years and provided many jobs and memories. I feel strongly that at this time customers continue to shop local on the market and support our traders who, like shops, have not been finding the current situation easy. Katie Carr is the brains behind Tommy and Lottie, a brand of unisex, ethical and sustainable clothing based in St Albans. Although there are so many more people online than there ever has been before, there is also more competition, so it is sometimes harder to be seen in a saturated marketplace. With all the social media platforms now based on paid ads, you have to pay for posts so that audiences can actually see it. You have to be more creative and clever with your campaigns and have a strategy and budget in place, which is hard for us small businesses to afford. The other challenge is actually doing more physical events and pop-ups, as most have been cancelled this year. There is nothing better than chatting to people about the business and them actually physically seeing the quality and designs. She has her own argument for why people should shop local. I think there has been a shift in how people are now thinking about their local retailers since the pandemic. People are not travelling as far to shop, so want to walk into the city on a much more regular basis and have shops to go to, but also want the convenience and feel safer by shopping online. But let's face it, look at the state of our environment, so if you want to help our planet, start by shopping local as much as possible. Our independent retailers are unique. They are the heart of what makes our community St Albans the great place it is, and it helps the environment. Shopping locally reduces your carbon footprint and keeps the money in the local economy.
Blooming great. Bloom Club brings all our generations together again. And there's a lovely photograph of some felt flowers, which I'll explain in the article, and of one of the residents of Field House being engaged in making them. Residents of a Harpen and Care home have been getting crafty this month, contributing to the community's collaborative project. Field House Care Home was invited to join Bloom Club, a community project organised by charity Wholehearted Childhood, to keep residents entertained and enable them to be part of the community while in lockdown. Funded by the Coronavirus Community Support Fund, Bloom Club is a nature-based arts community project. It is working with other intergenerational groups across Hertfordshire to bring everyone together, including foster families, school children, and the elderly. Field House was gifted with a craft kit and plants and used the petals to create a yellow dye, which then coloured the material and enabled each resident to sew together a small felt flower. The decorative flowers will be shared with the Bloom Club to be assembled together with flowers created by other community groups for a unified piece of floral art, with each flower having been made by a different person from the area. Helen Nisteler, director at Wholehearted Childhood, said, "It's wonderful to be working with Field House and to see different generations connected through a shared creative endeavour. The flower garland is going to be a lovely symbol of how communities pull together through difficult times." The garland will go on display at Highfield Oval, Harpenden, where flowers for dyeing, drying and arranging will be grown to enable more nature-based community crafts to take place in the future. It will also take a tour of Hertfordshire, visiting the care homes and schools of those involved, with a stint at Field House in December. Home manager at Field House, April Parrott-Carter, added, "We thoroughly enjoyed being a part of Bloom Club. It's been a fun and engaging project for our residents to be involved in and allowed them to stay connected to the community, of which most have been heavily involved in for most of their lives. We're particularly excited to proudly display the finished garland here at the home in December and will be interested to see if the residents can spot which flower is theirs."
Spurs under 21 star shoots and scores for hospice. Tottenham under 21 footballer and St Albans resident Hannah Coote ran 71 lengths of a football pitch in memory of Anand Linda to help fundraise for the charity that cared for her, the Rennie Grove Hospice Care. Anand Linda died this September after being diagnosed with lung cancer, but was able to stay at home with a family with help from Rennie Grove's Hospice at Home team. Hannah said, "To be with us was very special to her. She couldn't have chosen a better place to be. The care that Rennie Grove provided was exactly what we needed. Their specialist care really helped." While 71 lengths of a pitch may seem arbitrary, Hannah landed on that figure to mark what would have been her nan's 71st birthday. "I absolutely adored her," said Hannah on her fundraising page. "She was hilarious, so caring, way too generous, and we were very close. We miss her so much. However, we'll remember and reflect on all the happy and funny memories we shared over the years. She would find me crazy for doing this, but I'm doing this to celebrate her life on her birthday and for everyone at the hospice who deal with this day to day." Hannah's fundraising for Rennie Grove has reached over £2,000 already, smashing her original target of £500. On completing the challenge on Friday, October the 31st, Hannah said, "I am over the moon to have raised so much money. I never imagined I would get to £1,000, let alone £2,215. I'm just so happy it's going to such an amazing cause who have been very grateful for the support." Hannah described a challenge, saying, "It was tough going, especially as I had a 2-hour training session with Spurs that morning and then coach for an hour beforehand. But it was something I had so much motivation for, to do it for my nan and for all the people who had kindly donated and for the Rennie Grove nurses I am so grateful for. To have my closest friends and family there to support me on the day meant the world and was definitely a big help." And accompanying the article is a picture of Hannah with her mum and dad after she'd finished running 71 lengths of the pitch, and all three of them have huge smiles on their faces.
Westminster Diary. Remembering military on the front line in COVID battle. St Albans MP Daisy Cooper offers her take on a week in Westminster. "It was a huge honour to lay a wreath at the St Albans War Memorial on Armistice Day. The remembrance was obviously very different this year, and we were unable to have our usual remembrance parade on Sunday. However, the small socially distanced service was poignant, and it was a privilege to pay my respects. My granddad is a veteran himself, and he would usually take part in a service. However, instead, as of the times, this year he contributed by reading a verse of For the Fallen down the phone to his vicar. She recorded it and played it at his local outdoor service. This year was different in other ways too. I was particularly struck by the military nurse who spoke at the annual Festival of Remembrance led by Prince Charles at the Royal Albert Hall. It was moving, hearing her talk about not just the friends that she had lost in Afghanistan, but also in the NHS in the fight against COVID-19. For many who have lost loved ones, the front line has felt much closer to home this year. The military have played such a vital role in our battle against this devastating virus. From delivering food parcels to those in need, to swiftly constructing the Nightingale hospitals, we owe them our thanks. The coronavirus crisis has also highlighted the mammoth role of those nurses and doctors on the medical front line, drawing parallels with those on military tours. The Liberal Democrats have consistently called for a pay rise for NHS and care staff over recent years to recognise their true importance. Back in April, we also called for an extra £29 a day to reward the NHS staff working on the front line during the pandemic, akin to the payment that those in military service receive on active duty. We have also called for all key workers to receive a coronavirus service medal. While this year's services didn't have the same military grandeur as previous years, the community efforts were heartening. The lamppost poppies in Brickett Wood and Chiswell Green, and the huge numbers of people wearing pin badge poppies in our high streets, sent out a strong, clear message. In St Albans, we will remember them.
Lights, camera, action. 7 films shot on location in St Albans and the surrounding area. Filmmakers have plenty of locations to choose from in Hertfordshire, with everything from picturesque countryside to historic stately homes. St Albans Cathedral and the city's Roman aesthetic have also been used as backdrops to many films and TV series. Following the launch of Creative England's new Filming in England website, Alan Davis looks at 7 films made in the county. The city of St Albans has an impressive filmmaking history. It was the birthplace of Arthur Melbourne Cooper, a pioneer of British filmmaking in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In 1908, he opened in St Albans Hertfordshire's first permanent cinema as we know them today. The much-celebrated filmmaker Stanley Kubrick also settled in the area on the Chiddickbury Estate between St Albans and Harpenden. Kubrick made a number of his movies, including The Shining, down the road at the famous Elstree Film Studios in Boreham Wood. Warner Brothers Studios Leavesden is also nearby. The Cathedral City's strong film heritage inspired actress and casting director Leonie Kibbe to create St Albans' first film festival in 2013. Here are some of the movies made in the district and the surrounding area. 1. Johnny English. Rowan Atkinson's bungling secret agent Johnny English is no stranger to Hertfordshire. In his first action comedy caper, Johnny English thwarts the coronation of John Malkovich's French villain, Pascal Sauvage, in scenes shot inside St Albans Cathedral. The nave was used as a substitute for Westminster Abbey. Atkinson returned to the county for sequel Johnny English Reborn, with the golf course at Brockett Hall this time featuring prominently, along with a helicopter cutting down trees. Number 2. First Night. St Albans Cathedral was also a film location for this 1995 movie starring the late Sean Connery, who died last month. Connery played King Arthur in this medieval-set movie based on Arthurian legend. The cast also includes Richard Gere as Lancelot and Julia Ormond as Guinevere, with the movie's wedding scene filmed in the Lady Chapel. The cathedral was also used in 2017 for scenes from the second series of Netflix, The Crown. 3. Saving Private Ryan. When the British Aerospace factory closed in Hatfield in the 1990s, the airfield was left deserted. That made it the perfect location for Steven Spielberg's Oscar-winning World War II blockbuster starring Tom Hanks, Matt Damon, Vin Diesel and Tom Sizemore. The war-torn French village set from the movie was built entirely on the old de Havilland site near Smallford. Spielberg and Hanks returned to the location a few years ago to shoot most of hit HBO TV miniseries Band of Brothers in Hatfield. This time the aerodrome was used to represent a dozen different European towns. Filming also took place in the grounds of Hatfield House and on the Ayot Greenway between Ayot St Peter and Wheatamstead. 4. The Shining. Here's Johnny. This horror movie, adapted from Stephen King's novel, celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. Although set in Colorado, Stanley Kubrick filmed most of The Shining across multiple stages at Elstree Studios. The legendary director took over the studios in 1978-79 for a year of filming, with Jack Nicholson starring as the movie's central character, Jack Torrance. 5. Birthday Girl. This 2001 film starring Nicole Kidman and Ben Chaplin was set in St Albans. Chaplin plays John Buckingham, a lonely 30-something bank clerk from St Albans, who orders mail-order bride Nadia, Nicole Kidman, from Russia on the internet. But the Eastern Bloc beauty comes with a shady past. The erotic comedy thriller was directed by Jez Butterworth, who grew up and went to school in St Albans. 6. Incendiary. Several scenes from Incendiary, starring Michelle Williams, Trainspotting's Ewan McGregor and Matthew McFadden, were shot in St Albans. St Peter Street and, of course, the Abbey were used as backdrops in the film, which is set in the aftermath of a terrorist attack in London. 7. The Favourite. This Oscar-winning historical comedy drama was mostly filmed on location at Hatfield House and features a stellar cast led by Olivia Colman, Rachel Weisz, and Emma Stone. All three female leads won Academy Award nominations for their roles in Yorgos Lanthimos' acerbic, and often very rude, look at court life during Queen Anne's reign. Broadchurch star Olivia Colman won the Best Actress Oscar as the tragic, gout-ridden monarch. But it's the power play between Rachel Weisz's character, the Duchess of Marlborough, and Emma Stone as her cousin, servant Abigail, that provides the sparks as the pair jostle for the Queen's affections, both in and out of her bed. The real-life Sarah Churchill, the Duchess of Marlborough, was from St. Albans. And the article is illustrated with lots of pictures, including a close-up of Stanley Kubrick and the poster of Saving Private Ryan.
And here are the suggestions for radio programmes you might like to listen to in the coming week, starting with Saturday, November 21st. On Radio 4 at 2:45 p.m, you can hear a dramatisation of the James Bond story Moonraker, starring Toby Stevens. There's more drama on Radio 4 Extra at 6 p.m, a dramatisation of King Solomon's Mines, H. Rider Haggard's novel about a hunter employed to help a man find his missing brother, who was searching for a legendary lost diamond mine. This week's edition of Archive on 4 focuses on Beatle George Harrison. In All Things Must Pass, 50 years on, composer Nitin Sawhney marks the 50th anniversary of Harrison's triple LP, a massive success that yielded the first solo Beatle number one, My Sweet Lord. Among the contributors are Harrison's widow, Olivia, Jules Holland and Michael Palin. It's on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. And still on Radio 4 at 10:15 in The Moral Maze, Michael Burke presents a debate about a moral or ethical issue arising from the week's news. On to Sunday, November 22nd. Desert Island Discs is at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, presented as usual by Lauren Laverne. Over on Radio 3 at 5:30 p.m, this week's edition of Words and Music is called Razorblade. From barbers to seashells, sharp notes to sharp tongues and witty words, the programme includes works that relate to the phrase razor sharp. Jane Austen, Dorothy Parker, Rupert Graves, Graham Greene, Herman Melville, Malcolm X and Helen Scales all feature, as does the music of Bach, Rossini, Gorngold and Stephen Sondheim, and a recording by Ethel Merman. 7 p.m. on Radio 4, and this week's Strictly story is Jive. A teenager who had a leg amputated sets out to attend a dance lesson every week, but always gives up and goes home halfway to the studio. It's followed on Radio 4 at 7:15 by Saucepans for Spitfires, the first episode of Dot, a comedy set during the Second World War. The Radio Times choice is Drama on 3, Life is a Radio in the Dark, a new play by Will Eno, written especially for actor Toby Jones. When Davey Maskelyne embarks on sonic therapy to restore his memory so he can help solve a crime, the treatment leads to a reckoning with a past he never believed he could recover. It's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. on Sunday. And finally for the weekend, Classic FM, 9 p.m, the guest on Moira Stewart Meets is the one and the only David Jason. On to those programmes now that are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday. So the same radio station at the same time, Monday to Friday. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Same time, same radio station. You got it. At 9:45 on Radio 4 and repeated at 12:30 each day is Book of the Week. Mycologist Merlin Sheldrake reads from his book about the fascinating world of fungi. He begins by seeking to explain how all life on Earth relies on fungi. On Radio 4 Longwave, as always, the daily service is broadcast each day at 9:45 a.m. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 on Radio 4 and repeated at 7:45 p.m. is D for Dexter, produced in collaboration with Children in Need beneficiary Say It. On Radio 3 at 12 noon, the composer of the week focuses on the life and work of the late Renaissance Italian composer Carlo Gesualdo da Venosa, notorious for the murder of his first wife and her lover. just after midday on Radio 4 and repeated at 10:45 p.m. Grief is the Thing with Feathers is the debut novel by Max Porter, which tells of a family who suddenly lose their wife and mother. Dad struggles to cope until an unexpected visitor arrives. Crow promises to stay until they no longer need him. And over on Radio 4 Extra, there's a dramatisation every day, Monday to Friday, same time, same channel, Radio 4 Extra. They Do It With Mirrors, an Agatha Christie murder mystery. You can hear it three times a day. So if you miss it, you can catch up with it. 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. On to those individual programmes now to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, November 23rd. On Radio 4 at 11 a.m, On the Verge tells the story of 24-year-old actor Sadie Jean Shirley, who received her break when she was cast in City of Angels, due to open in London's West End in March. Then lockdown happened. Will she be able to afford the luxury of waiting for the theatres to open to restart her career? That's followed at 11:30 by How to Vaccinate the World, continuing the series that began last week, in which Tim Harford explores the global undertaking to deliver a mass vaccination programme to end the COVID-19 pandemic. There's drama on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. with an adaptation of Moby Dick by Herman Melville, about a captain's obsessive chase for a great white whale. The story concludes tomorrow at the same time, so Tuesday. Over on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m, there's an edition of Just a Minute from 2017, hosted, of course, by the late Nicholas Parsons. Finally, at 7:30, Radio 3 in Concert features some of the winners of this year's Royal Philharmonic Society Awards, featuring performances by some of the winners in various categories, including Outstanding Instrumentalist, Singer, Conductor, and the recipient of this year's prestigious Gold Medal Award. Then, on Tuesday, November 24th, Radio 4, 11:30 a.m, the second of four programmes under the heading My Albion is Red Dragon, White Dragon, which this time focuses on Wales. The Radio 3 lunchtime concert at 1 p.m. marks the 75th anniversary of the Cheltenham Music Festival, held every summer since 1945 but cancelled this year due to the pandemic, with the first of four programmes featuring performances by some of the artists originally scheduled for the event. It's live from St David's Hall in Cardiff. At 2:15, the drama on Radio 4 is Billy Ruffian, the story of Napoleon's last weeks before his long exile on St Helena, as the Emperor played cat and mouse with the crew of HMS Bellerophon, known affectionately as Billy Ruffian. The theme on the short documentaries in the series Shortcuts is miniatures, including a song about the joys of singing, an elevator ride from the poet Paul Farley, a snappy surrealist game, and a journey into the world of the planet's tiniest inhabitants. Shortcuts, Radio 4, 3 p.m. And at 9 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, there's a programme from 2016, Gillian Reynolds' Audiophile, in which Gillian Reynolds celebrates 50 years as a professional radio reviewer. Moving on to Wednesday, November 25th, at 9 a.m. on Radio 4, this week's edition of Britain in 10 Operas is called Football and Fishermen, in which baritone Roderick Williams picks 10 highlights from over three centuries of opera in Britain and discovers what our opera story can tell us about the British identity. On Radio 4 at 2:15, there's the first of a five-part romantic comedy called Where This Service Will Terminate. After Susie sits down next to David on the Cornwall Express from Paddington to Penzance, an intense relationship develops over the course of their eventful five-hour journey. At 3:30 p.m. on Radio 3, Choral Evensong comes from the Chapel of Clare College, Cambridge. And Radio 2 has a treat for folk music fans. 7 p.m. you can hear Radio 2's Folk Favourites of 2020, followed at 9 p.m. in concert featuring Joan Baez in a concert recorded in 1999, all on Radio 2. For Thursday, November 26th, at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4, there's the first in a new series of Behind the Scenes, which this week features Carlos Acosta and the Birmingham Royal Ballet. The programme hears Acosta's rags-to-riches story, follows rehearsals for the planned Christmas performances of The Nutcracker. The afternoon concert on Radio 3 is at 2 p.m, a performance of Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro. On Radio 4, the drama at 2.15 is Lanny, a dramatisation of Max Porter's mythical novel. 10-year-old Lanny and his parents have moved to a village outside London, where the locals are suspicious of outsiders. It's also the realm of mythical figure, dead Papa Toothwort, who listens to the sounds and talk of the village, and to Lanny in particular. Then one day, Lanny disappears. Still on Radio 4 at 8.30, our final highlight on Thursday, Last Flight to Newquay is the story of Cornwall Airport Newquay as it faces hard times and tough choices after the collapse of regional airline Flybe. So we finish on Friday, November 27th, 11 a.m, Radio 4, Africa United in Manchester, tells the story of the 5th Pan-African Congress held in Manchester 75 years ago. At 3 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, the Inspector Allen mystery is When in Rome, in which the detective is incognito in Italy and on the trail of a vast 1970s drug syndicate. In Short Works at 3.45 on Radio 4, Cometco the Quiet One is by playwright Hannah Vincent. Confident Erin and her quiet colleague Cometco arrive at an empty hotel to prepare for a conference where they'll be competing for a place on a sales team. And on the BBC World Service at 8.30 p.m, Crowd Science untangles complex climate modelling to find out how confident we can be that global warming is also exacerbating wildfires, and looks at preventative measures. As always, we do hope you enjoy your listening this week. Have a safe one too.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes for the Hearts ad. Nature, yoga for the mind. There's really only one thing to write about this month, and that is the discovery of a little bird in my garden that was not just a rarity for Hertfordshire, but also the 100th species I have recorded in my garden. It was a fitting milestone for my garden bird list, but also an emphatic confirmation of something I've been discovering throughout this crazy year of lockdowns and restrictions. The great richness and wealth of local wildlife and nature right on our doorsteps, and in particular in our gardens. Our gardens and the views they afford, however limited, are windows on the wider world of nature. The joy of discovering something unusual or beautiful or complex in the confines of our often mundane domesticity enlivens and connects us with an infinite world beyond ourselves. To be awakened to this world with all its possibilities and be drawn out of ourselves, even momentarily, is perhaps one of the healthiest things that can happen to us. In that moment, we are no longer conscious of self with all its needs and wants, but present to something outside of us, something totally other, and if we allow it, totally engaging. It is also real, and importantly, not manufactured or maintained by us. Nature is fresh air and wide open space for our minds, in contrast to the black holes of work and online interaction that, like never before, have merged and deepened the ennui. If our sitting rooms provide space for online yoga sessions, our gardens give us space to perform mental yoga if we take the time to look and even listen. Nature exercises our minds because it requires that we watch, we wait and listen, and that we learn. For the most part, we simply do not know, and this in itself is refreshing. Too often we live in closed worlds, unable to see new possibilities or believe there are any, and the danger is we stagnate in boredom. Nature, even in our humble gardens, offers the chance of surprise, that critical element required to break our mental moulds as something totally unexpected happens. That is precisely the form that bird number 100 took as I scanned through the flock of tits flitting through the garden. My binoculars settled on a tiny bird, not much bigger than a goldcrest, and I knew immediately that it was a yellow-browed warbler. True to its name, it sported a thin, pale yellow eyebrow and similar stripes on its wings. It is one of the aptly named leaf warblers that flit and flutter through the trees, at times looking like falling leaves as they tumble to catch tiny insects in the foliage. This little bird has been extending its range east from Siberia, and has become a regular autumn visitor to coastal counties. More recently, individuals have begun to turn up further inland, and the number of records for Hertfordshire has increased too. My surprise was therefore not so much that it was there, but rather that it had chosen my garden and that moment to appear as the 100th garden bird. What were the chances of that? It was the perfect reward for the increased time spent in the garden this year, watching and waiting, often first thing at dawn, and another highlight in an extraordinary year of garden bird watching. Of course, it may not be birds that capture your attention. I sometimes think the enjoyment of nature is like a bus journey, with the option to get off at various stops. One stop is birds, but others might alight on insects, butterflies, moths or beetles, or fungi or flowers. Wherever you step off, there is the opportunity to drill down and plumb the depths of whatever facet of nature has taken your interest. I have yet to set a moth trap overnight, but I know many people have during lockdown. It is the first step to uncovering a nocturnal world of wonder, as these oft-dismissed creatures are drawn to the light in all their variety and surprising splendour. They might be fodder for birds and bats, but theirs is a world equally rich and diverse, and there every night in our gardens for the discovering.
I'm Sue. This story is from Hertfordshire Life, and it's called The Greatest Traveller. Exploring ancient civilizations and rising powers, Violet Cressy Marks became the most travelled woman of her age. 50 years after her death, we look at her incredible life. It's by Gillian Thornton. Package holidays and low-cost airlines have revolutionised our horizons over recent decades in ways that would have been unthinkable even 50 years ago. So when the COVID-19 pandemic slammed the brakes on global travel this year, we all realised just how much we have taken freedom to travel for granted. Intrepid explorer Violet Cressy Marks, former resident of Hazelwood House, now Hunton Park, on the outskirts of Watford, crisscrossed the world from the 1920s through to the 1950s as a scientist, reporter and explorer, long before travel insurance, routine inoculations and high-speed transport were the norm. When Violet became a fellow of the Royal Geographic Society in 1922, fewer than 8% of its 5,614 fellows were women. Fellows didn't need to hold geographical qualifications, explains Julie Carrington of the RGS Library. A general interest in geography, travel, or related matters was sufficient, and the ability to pay the annual subscription, of course. Violet had no trouble meeting any of the criteria. She had already travelled extensively and was declared a lady of independent means by her RGS proposer, who had met her in Alaska, Japan, and Java. So who was this extraordinary female pioneer? Born Violet Olivia Rutley on 9th of June 1895 in West Wickham, Greater London, Violet's early upbringing by wealthy parents is little documented. In October 1917, at just 22, she married Maurice Cressy Marks, a captain in the North Lanarkshire Regiment. But Violet clearly had her sights set beyond the shores of England. Their son William was just 4 when in 1925 his globe-trotting mother set off to travel overland from Cairo to Cape Town, an archaeologist first and foremost, going on to study ancient civilizations including Khmer, the Incas and Aztecs. Violet was also interested in zoology and ethnology. By 1931, at 36 years old, Violet was already on her 4th round-the-world journey, no mean feat at that time, let alone for a woman. Utterly fearless and unflappable, she generally travelled alone, pushing the boundaries of science wherever possible. She carried out archaeological studies from Egypt to Ethiopia, Palestine to Persia, bringing back still and moving pictures, many from politically sensitive areas. Some are lodged today in the archives of the British Film Institute in London. Violet's marriage to Maurice was short-lived, although she kept his name after their divorce. By the time she married her second husband, Francis Edward Fisher, in 1931, she had already been to Albania and the Balkans, trekked through the Arctic with reindeer sleighs, and travelled through the Amazon and Andes to Peru by canoe and on foot. It was through Fisher that her connection with Hertfordshire began. A wealthy farmer and meat wholesaler in Watford, Fisher owned Hazelwood House, a large country house and estate in Abbots Langley. Violet had two more sons in the early 30s, defying tradition by naming them Ocean and Forest. Photographs in the archives of London's National Portrait Gallery show an elegant and serious woman in a variety of contrasting poses. Taken in 1926 by photographer Lafayette, the images show Violet in a Grecian-style evening dress with pearls and a bracelet around her upper arm, dressed in a plaid cape and a neat brimmed hat, and wearing a leather flying suit with her cap hanging nonchalantly from one hand. She looks self-contained but unassuming, essential qualities, one imagines, for a lone female traveller who needed to blend in. And despite her bravery and independence, she was, by all accounts, a modest woman who didn't seek fame or publicity. She does not, however, seem to have concerned herself too much with family obligations. Seemingly unencumbered by her husband and three young sons, Violet continued to travel extensively in an age where just getting to a destination could take several weeks. And yet she wrote just two books. Up the Amazon and Over the Andes was published in 1932, while 1940's Journey to China described her ambitious route from Madalay to the Kobi Nor on the fringes of the Gobi Desert. A widely quoted anecdote from the South American narrative gives a measure of Violet's stoicism and calm demeanour. Woken one night in the Amazon by a snake biting her below the self that she wasn't, I decided on coffee, a walk, and sleep. If I was going to die, I was at peace with the world, so there was nothing to worry about. But it was as a journalist and a war correspondent that Violet's words found the widest audience. In 1935, just a year after Forrest was born, she took the first motor transport from Addis Ababa to Nairobi during the Italian invasion and visited Ethiopian and Eritrean war fronts to send back written reports and cinefilm. 2 years later, she set off overland from Mandalay. 2 years later, she set off overland from Mandala to Peking, now Beijing, interviewing Mao Tse-tung for many hours at the remote cave dwellings at Yenning. Here, at the wartime communist headquarters, Violet studied the training methods of the Red Army. Not surprisingly, she was much in demand as a public speaker. In a talk to the Royal Central Asian Society in November 1938, Violet took a rapt audience behind the scenes of a year that involved spending 3.5 months in China, then Serbia, and after a brief spell in Europe, finished with 5 months back in China. Small wonder she spent little time at her Hertfordshire home. Her experience of world travel and dubious destinations led her to becoming special correspondent in Chongqing, China, for the Daily Express during the Second World War. Her eldest son, William Cressy Marx, served as a flight lieutenant with the RAF, but lost his life in March 1945, aged only 23, and lies today at Takyuan War Cemetery in Myanmar. After the war, Violet continued to report for the Express from the Nuremberg trials, but peacetime saw her back on the road, making a seventh round-the-world journey in 1955 and another a year later. It was said she visited every country in the world and had travelled by every mode of transport. Francis was occasionally allowed to accompany his wife abroad, but he largely lived at the couple's London property, leaving Hazelwood House empty for long periods or rented out. One of its most notable tenants was Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, exiled from his own country after the invasion by Italy in 1936. During the Second World War, the property became temporary offices for the Illustrated News Limited and Odum's Press, the base for publications such as the Tatler, the Bystander and the Illustrated London News. Part of the estate was also taken over by the Ministry of Defence for production of Mosquito and Halifax aircraft. Frances retained the estate until the late 1950s, and in 1971 it was bought by businessman Paul Hember, who changed its name to Hunton Park. The dilapidated mansion was restored and turned into Hunton Park Hotel, first owned by the De Vere chain and now by Accor Hotels. Violet Cressy Marx died at her South Kensington home on September 10, 1970, and was buried in Hertfordshire at Langleybury Church, where her son William is recorded on the war memorial. Throughout her extraordinary life, she proved that women could achieve just as much as men, and often more. Her obituary in the Geographical Journal, published by the RGS, includes the observation, "Determination is the principal characteristic of Mrs. Cressy Mark's equipment as a traveller. She could not," it continues, "have hoped to accomplish many of her journeys without a fine disregard for safety and personal comfort." There is a popular belief that many of her trips to politically sensitive areas were facilitated in the corridors of government, possibly by the Secret Service. In her will, Violet asked that her biography be written by Bernard Ricketson Hatt, former editor-in-chief of Reuters, and that a copy be shown to the chief of MI5. But Ricketson Hatt predeceased her, and the biography was never written. If she had secrets, they remain that way. Her list of accomplishments, however, speak for themselves. As Vice Admiral Osborne declared when he introduced a 1938 talk at the Royal Central Asian Society, "She is well known all over the world as a very famous traveller and explorer, although I don't think she is known as widely as she should be, probably owing to her intense modesty." He described Violet as the greatest living traveller of this age. 50 years after her death, it's very hard to disagree.
Hello, this is Bill, and with Bonfire Night earlier this month, author Harry Smee recounts the explosive story of his family's firework company, Brock's, creators of wonders and war-changing weapons. The most famous pyrotechnist in the world, the Fire King, Arthur Brock, moved his huge operation to Hertfordshire countryside in 1933. More than 200 workers relocated from Sutton to the 220-acre Woodhall farm in Hemel Hempstead, and Arthur built them two streets of houses, named after the London pleasure gardens Ranelagh and Vauxhall, where the family firm had once entertained London society. The move continued the remarkable history of Brock's Fireworks, which began in 1698 in Islington. Renowned for the summer seasons at the Crystal Palace and its Brock's Benefit, a huge annual display, the company was synonymous with fireworks the world over. What was less well known was its links to warfare. In 1891, Brock's won a gold medal for its signal gun at the first Royal Naval Exhibition in Chelsea. An impressed visitor was Kaiser Wilhelm II, and that summer he was entertained at Crystal Palace with a Brock's display. So delighted was the Emperor, he asked his uncle, the future King Edward VII, to introduce him to Arthur for a detailed discussion. A quarter of a century later, Arthur manufactured millions of munitions to be used by the British forces in the First World War against Germany, and his son Frank was to become one of the most significant British officers of the conflict. Commissioned into the Army, the Navy, and the RAF, Frank worked as a spy, an intelligence officer, and as an inventor. One who knew him well described Frank as having a phenomenal memory and a natural ability as a chemist, perhaps not surprising since he was an eighth-generation pyrotechnist. In pursuit of keeping his customers happy, Frank's ancestor, the firm's founder, John Brock, blew himself up on Bonfire Night 1720. John's great-great-grandson, William Brock, suffered a major setback when his house in Baker's Row off Whitechapel Road and most of the surrounding houses were reduced to ash and rubble in 1825 due to the explosion of his raw firework materials. Luckily for William, he had popped out with his leading hands for breakfast and missed the conflagration. In due course, the business passed to William's grandson. Charles Brock died early of natural causes, but in his short life, pioneered the use of magnesium for pyrotechnic illumination and introduced thrilling new concepts, including huge set pieces, living fireworks, and portraiture. He changed the way fireworks were manufactured, transported, and displayed, and in doing so he made Brock's the most famous firework manufacturer in the world, with factories in the UK, the USA, Turkey, and Australia. He also supplied Napoleon III's armies with pyrotechnics for his war with Prussia in 1870. On Charles's death in 1881, his brother Arthur took the reins and, following in the family tradition, built the business to even greater success. He placed Brock's firmly within the British imperial project, travelling the world and using his fireworks at home and abroad to aid British diplomacy. His son Frank was born in 1884. With his five brothers, he attended Dulwich College, where he blew up his form-room stove in a wayward experiment. The headmaster rather admired Fireworks Brock and let him off a disciplinary beating. After leaving Dulwich, he joined the family firm and for 12 years quartered the globe, orchestrating spellbinding displays. In 1905, Frank managed a colossal firework display at a review of the British fleet at Spithead as part of the Entente Cordiale with France. He may well have been spotted at this time, for he began to work on smokes for the Royal Navy. One country in which Brock's had built a good reputation was Germany. As its militarism grew more worrying, Frank, presenting himself as an American tourist, managed to enter the Zeppelin works on an open day. At close quarters, he was able to inspect the fearsome hydrogen-filled airships. Soon after war broke out in the summer of 1914, Frank was commissioned into the army, but made his interest in Zeppelins known to Murray Suter, who ran the Royal Naval Air Service. Suter borrowed him from the Royal Artillery, and arranging a temporary commission, sent him to France. In Paris, with another British officer, they were given false papers before making their way into Switzerland. From there they entered Germany and reconnoitred the Zeppelin works in Friedrichshafen on the shore of Lake Constance. On his return to England, Winston Churchill ordered him to command a secret research establishment in East London. Here, as Zeppelin raids on the capital grew more intense, Frank developed an incendiary bullet designed to explode on contact with the outer material of the Zeppelin. The bullet would destroy airships from the first night it was used in September 1916, ending the Kaiser's dream of air supremacy. Londoners cheered as finally their country was able to hit back at the huge monsters that had killed and terrified them for 18 months. After finding an answer to the Zeppelins, Frank turned his attention to the U-boats that were sinking increasing numbers of Allied ships. He helped prevent German domination of the Channel by inventing giant flares that lit up the sea at night and forced U-boats into deep minefields. The technology was still used in the Pathfinder flares dropped by the RAF in the Second World War to illuminate targets. Another of his inventions, artificial fog, to mask attacking vessels, played a pivotal role in the war's most daring raid at Zeebrugge on St. George's Day 1918. There, Frank destroyed several gun positions personally before succumbing in a sword fight on the sea wall. After his death, the Navy installed his smokescreen on many ships and the Army on British tanks, and it was still being used by the Royal Navy in the Second World War. From the Hemel factory, the great shows were created for the official peace display of 1946 and the Queen's coronation display of 1953. Brock's continued to flourish through the 1950s and 60s, providing most of the displays used as the British Empire was dismantled. In 1971, the factory was sold for housing, and the business moved to Scotland. Today, thousands live on the Hemel site, where millions of fireworks and military munitions were once made. For many years, the home of the most famous firework company in the world. We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Elizabeth, Sarah, Dominic, Ian, and Sue, and of course John for the radio listings, and Rupert for his nature notes. Steve will be here next week with News Extra, but that's all from me in November 2020. We close with Fallen Leaves by the Rackhouse Pilfer. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and stay safe.
When we stole ourselves out of that town, now in my memories I can see so many roads we've been down. I've got a picture who we once were, hard to believe it's you and me. We were singing a song about freedom and change. The look in your eyes like it meant everything. My Maria, my sweet refrain, my Lucia, falling leaves will remain. Secrets anymore. Here I stand, let the hammer fall. No hidden thoughts, no disguise. You look at me with perfect eyes. Always remember the times we had. Those not with us anymore. Keep them safe inside your heart. Keep them safe, my friend. My Maria, my sweet refrain. My Lucia, falling leaves will remain. Falling leaves will remain. Come away, come away, come and dance away our cares. No, there's no one here but friends. Let's go out and dance away our cares. Come away, come away, come away, come and dance away our cares. No, there's no one here but friends. Let's go out and dance away our cares. My Maria, my sweet refrain, my Lucia, falling leaves will.